From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. During the Gulf War, journalist Molly Moore had a front-row seat for the ground war, traveling with a three-star general and his troops. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Molly Moore of The Washington Post about covering the most chaotic and underreported part of the war. She's written a new book called A Woman at War. Also, we talk with the enigmatic expatriate Paul Bowles, the writer Norman Mailer once described as opening the world of the hip. Bowles has lived in Tangier since the 30s. He rarely gives interviews and nowadays rarely leaves his home. And book critic John Leonard reviews Cape of Storms, a new novel by South African writer Andre Brink. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The House has passed a bill that would prevent employers from hiring permanent replacements for striking workers. The so-called strikebreaker bill passed by a vote of 239 to 190. The measure's been a high priority for organized labor, but it faces dim prospects in the Senate. Conservative Democrats in the Senate said the House should never have acted on the matter, since it has little chance of passage and puts lawmakers in the difficult position of choosing between business and labor. John Connally, three-term governor of Texas and former cabinet member under Presidents Kennedy and Nixon, died today in Houston at the age of 76. Connally's death comes nearly 30 years after he was shot and almost killed while riding next to President Kennedy in Dallas. Wade Goodwin reports.
Former Texas Governor John Connally got his start in politics in the 1930s, running Congressman Jake Pickle's campaign for student president at the University of Texas. Pickle then introduced Connally to a young congressman named Lyndon Johnson, and the two became fast friends, and Johnson became Connally's political mentor. At Johnson's behest, Connally was appointed Secretary of the Navy by John Kennedy in 1960. But Connally served only until December of 1961, when he resigned to return to Texas to run for governor. Connally was elected to 3 two-year terms, voluntarily retiring from office in 1968. On November 22, 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald shot and killed Kennedy and seriously wounded Connally as the two rode through the streets of downtown Dallas. Connally bore both the physical and mental wounds from that day for the rest of his life. For National Public Radio, I'm Wade Goodwin in Austin.
Several conservative political groups walked out of democracy talks in South Africa today in a squabble over negotiating priorities. The group said they'd consult their leaders about whether to return to the talks. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
The predominantly Zulu Inkatha Freedom Party led the walkout by a conservative coalition of eight black and white political groupings. The walkout came after the 26-party negotiating council had rejected an Inkatha attempt to postpone the setting of a date for democratic elections. The negotiating council has provisionally agreed to an election date of next April 27th. Inkatha officials said a decision on whether to continue participating in the talks will be made after consulting with the party's top leaders. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 23 points to close at 3,492. The NASDAQ Composite Index was up almost a point to close at 697.3. Advancing issues led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. Nigeria's elections were clouded today as two groups filed challenges to the balloting before the results are in. The election was designed to return the country to democracy after 10 years of military rule. With official results in from 14 of Nigeria's 30 states, the Social Democratic Party appeared to be far in the lead. The election was challenged by a group that supports Nigeria's military dictator and wants to extend his rule until 1997. The losing political party has also filed a complaint, alleging that the elections were not free and fair. The Pepsi-Cola company has asked the FBI to investigate reports of possible product tampering. Since the weekend, people in seven states have reported finding syringes in cans of Pepsi. NPR's Elaine Corey reports.
At least 8 cases of product tampering have been reported to police, the first 2 in Washington State and Louisiana, followed by Wyoming, Ohio, Missouri, and Illinois. In each case, people said they found syringes in cans of regular or diet Pepsi. The Food and Drug Administration has launched a thorough investigation. FDA Commissioner David Kessler has issued this warning to consumers.
The best precaution remains a very simple one. Check the contents of the can.
According to Pepsi spokesman, no one has been injured, although on Sunday, a man in New Orleans said he cut his lip on a bent needle found in his soda can. So far, according to Pepsi, the FDA has not advised the company to order a recall of its products. I'm Elaine Corey reporting.
Food prices were up sharply in May, but energy costs made their biggest drop in 14 months. The net result was an overall gain of only 0.1% in consumer prices. The news helped ease fears that the United States is in for another surge in inflation. Those fears were aroused after a Labor Department report of a 0.4% gain in April. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During the Gulf War, while the Pentagon tried to control the press and censor information, journalist Molly Moore had a front-row seat. Through the 100-hour-long ground war, she traveled with Lieutenant General Walter Boomer, the general directing the Marines' attack against Iraqi forces. The general had invited her to observe the war from the vantage point of his command post. She says she knows of no other case in which a female journalist had ever accompanied such a senior commanding general onto the battlefield. During the war, Moore was the senior military correspondent for the Washington Post. Now she's the Post's New Delhi bureau chief. In her new book, A Woman at War, Moore gives her account of the war and her experiences covering it. When she started traveling with General Boomer, the troops were sleeping under their vehicles, but the general invited her to sleep in his tent. She accepted the invitation.
One of the things I did as a female, anytime you went out into the field with the troops, they always wanted to give you a little special consideration, let you stay in the best tent, you know, make sure you had a cot, even if some of the men didn't have cots.
Because you were a woman or because you were a reporter?
A little bit of both, but especially because I was a woman. And I always resisted that. I said, no, I'm going to stay the same place the men do, sleep in the same kind of places, eat what they eat. I don't want any special considerations. And I always, across the board, refused to accept any special concessions because I was female. In this case, initially, I wanted to say, no, if the troops are sleeping out there under the jeeps, I have my sleeping bag, I'll sleep there too. And then a split second later, I thought, this is the opportunity of a lifetime. No reporter has ever been able to go in a battle and be at the side of the general the entire time he's fighting the war. And sort of sleeping in the tent is a little bit of a misnomer. There wasn't much sleep to be had. But I did have access all night long to his conversations back to Schwarzkopf, his conversations with his commanders as the chaos was unfolding on the battlefield. It was just an extraordinary window on the ground war operation.
Give us a sense of some of the things that you learned by listening in on those conversations.
Well, I think people in the U.S. who were watching the war on TV had this view that it was a very surgical, antiseptic operation. What they saw on TV were film of missiles going through the tiny front doors of warehouses, and everything was kind of picture perfect and all the weapons worked. What I saw in the ground war was nothing like that. It was totally chaotic. There were mistakes made all over the battlefield. One of the incidents I describe in the book is a young tank commander who's on one of the very first tanks going through the Iraqi minefields. And as they get up to the edge of the minefield, there are some Marine trucks sitting on the edge of the minefield. And those trucks were going to guide them, the men in the trucks were going to guide them through the narrow lanes. One of the tanks behind this lead tank commander got itchy fingers, got scared in the situation, and fired, thinking those were enemy troops. So the young men in the first tank, their first view of war was their own men killing Marines in front of them. And there was chaos and mayhem all over the battlefield. On the second day of the war, which some of the toughest fighting occurred in the Marine sector in Kuwait, General Boomer, the senior commander, couldn't communicate with one of his top generals who was fighting some of the toughest war. And he would have to relay his messages back to a rear command post, and that command post would then relay them to the general who was out on the battlefield.
Can you take us to the night before the ground war started and tell us what kinds of words the commanders had for the troops and for the officers right before
the fighting?
Well, several hours before the fighting began, General Boomer called his entire headquarters staff together, and it was about 200 men and women who were at his command post, forward command post, just a few miles from the Kuwait border, and essentially gave them a very somber talk, saying he didn't know what was going to happen. It was very clear the war was probably going to start tonight, although if he wanted, President Bush could put a hold on it up until the last very minute. One of the most surprising things he told them was that essentially the ground war had already begun 2 days earlier. He already had units in Kuwait that were engaged in very tough firefights with the Iraqis. And at the time, the military was keeping that very secret from the American public. They didn't want the Iraqis to know exactly where they were going to be entering Kuwait. The mood in the camp was funeral parlor sober the night before. I talked to many of the generals and many of the troops, and many of them genuinely thought they were going to lose hundreds of young men going into the minefields and onto the battlefield. And it was one of the most tense situations I had ever witnessed anywhere, and was allowed to sit in on some of their meetings as they talked to the generals, as they talked to people out in the field. And there was just this tremendous strain etched on everyone's face. People looked 20 years older than they were. The burdens of the lives of tens of thousands of young troops on their shoulders.
I think it was one of the commanders who read part of the Henry V soliloquy right before the war.
Exactly. The commander, Brigadier General Tom Sage Droughty. He got the nickname and the call sign Sage because he was kind of much like a professor. He was looked up to and respected by both the men and the commanders. And moments before he got into his war wagon to go forward through the minefields and into the battle, he called his senior commanders together and read from them scenes out of Henry V. It was very emotional. Many of them were in tears at the time. And then he grabbed his rucksack, climbed into his armored personnel carrier, and took off for the battlefield.
You know, people in the military are trained to face death. You're a journalist, and you're not trained for that. How are you dealing with the possibility of impending death?
It's very frightening. When I got in the Chevy Blazer the morning that we took off to go into battle, Boomer's senior operations officer, Colonel Bill Steed, came up to me and said, ma'am, would you like a weapon? And I said, no, journalists are not allowed to use weapons, carry weapons in combat. And then he pulled out a little black book and said, may I have the name of your next of kin, please? And I kind of gulped and gave him my husband's name. I think one of the things that kept us all sane, the reporters who were out there covering the war, is there was so much going on, and your job was so difficult to do, not only getting the information, but writing your stories and getting them out, that at the time, we didn't have a lot of time to think about and dwell on the dangers and the risks. It was after it was all over, we kind of sat back and said, oh my God, you know, what have we just done?
Well, speaking of getting your stories out, you couldn't most of the time. Here you were risking your life to get out the story, and because of communications breakdowns, most of the time you couldn't get your story to the Washington Post.
Oh, it was the most frustrating period in my entire career as a journalist. One of the reasons that we had gone out with General Boomer is we assumed he would have good communications, that I would be able to get my stories back and get them to the Washington Post. The first night we were out on the battlefield, we ended up trapped in the middle of a minefield, surrounded by Iraqi soldiers, not knowing whether they were trying to shoot us or surrender to us. After 4 hours, they did eventually surrender and surrendered their weapons to the troops and the officers in our convoy. The second night, we got up a satellite dish, took about 5 hours to put it up, and a piece was missing. And they tried to call in helicopters. The cloud cover was too low. Helicopters couldn't get in. We couldn't get our story out. This was the biggest night of the war. I was sitting on the biggest story in the world. The Marines had surrounded Kuwait City. They were ready to liberate it, and there was just absolutely no way to get the story out.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Molly Moore, and she writes for The Washington Post. Her new book, A Woman at War, is about covering the war in the Gulf for The Post. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Molly Moore is my guest. She's now the New Delhi bureau chief for the Washington Post, but her new book, A Woman at War, is about covering the Gulf War and particularly the ground war for the Washington Post. Where exactly were you in the convoy of vehicles during the ground war?
Well, there were 11 vehicles in this convoy, and it was moving across the battlefield. General Boomer was talking to his commanders, trying to figure out where the worst battles were, where he needed to move men. I was right directly behind an armored personnel carrier that General Boomer and his chief operations officer were riding in. This was a personnel carrier outfitted with a dozen radios that allegedly would allow him to talk to his ground commanders. I was in a Chevy Blazer right behind that, and the Chevy Blazer carried the more sophisticated satellite communications that allowed him to talk to Riyadh and would have allowed, if he needed to talk to the Pentagon or Washington.
Well, you actually drove through minefields, right?
Right. They were marked with pink garbage cans.
So you could see all the mines?
You could see them just lay, in some cases, lying on top of the sand. The other thing you could see were just hundreds and hundreds of unexploded bombs that had been dropped by American bombers that hit the sand and didn't explode. And they were very dangerous, too. If you rolled over one of those, they could explode a tank.
How fast were you driving?
We were creeping, maybe 4 miles an hour. It was a very slow, arduous process, and the drivers would stay directly in the ruts of the tank in front of them, because no matter how many tanks and vehicles had traveled the same lane, and in some cases it was thousands of vehicles, the drivers were always fearful that maybe there would be one edge of a mine that hadn't been seen or hadn't been exploded and could hit their tank and explode.
Was there basically no talking in the vehicle during that drive?
Going through the minefields was very tense, and we listened, basically we're listening to the radios, trying to listen to the directions of those who were guiding us through the minefield, who were telling the drivers where to turn and where to look out for trouble.
There was, of course, the constant fear of gas and chemical weapons. There was a policy called selective unmasking that you witnessed being used. Why don't you explain what the policy was and when it was actually put into use when you were there?
Well, it was frightening to some of the troops on the ground. When there would be a gas alert and the military had all these fancy gadgets for reading whether there were gas particles in the air. And so when these machines set off a warning, everyone would scream, gas, gas, gas. That was the signal. And everyone knew it was no joke. And they put on their gas masks and their chemical suits. And then troops with dressed in their chemical gear would go out with other machines and test the air. And when it came out clear that, in fact, there was no gas, they would use one unit within a platoon or a company to what they call selective unmask. And that meant that they would ask, for instance, the men in one tank to take their mask off and basically see if they lived. And if they did, they would tell everyone else to take their mask off. So there is a scene I recount in the book in interviews with some of the young tankers who were on the first tanks going in, of a situation where their tank was ordered to unmask after one of these gas attacks during the war. And they were all terrified of taking off the mask. And finally, one of the young men did get up the courage, and he took his mask off. He started feeling all the effects of gas. He started feeling his chest constrict. His nose was running. He thought he was going to die. And then he saw a little fly buzzing around the tank and realized that, in fact, there was no gas. It was all psychological symptoms that he was feeling. But there was nothing that scared the troops out there more than the potential for gas. Every single one of them you would talk to would say, we can at least see where the bullets and artillery, see where they're coming from. We can't see where the gas is coming from.
I want to get back to something we were talking about earlier, and that is, sharing the tent with the general. On the nights that you share the tent with the general, were there awkward questions of etiquette that came up about how to behave as a woman journalist in the commander's tent?
Well, not really. There were two of them in the tent, General Boomer and his operations chief, Colonel Steed. And it was more a question of, what do you talk to these guys about who have the responsibility for 40,000 people on their shoulders and are fighting a war? My main concern was just not wanting to get in the way. And in some way, impeding their ability to do their job. I just wanted to be a fly on the wall watching all of this. And my biggest concern was getting in the way. So the most awkward moments for me had nothing to do with undressing or anything like that. We didn't undress. The most we did was take off a flak jacket when we could catch a few minutes sleep on a cot. For the most part, the general and the colonel were talking on their radios. They were scurrying around back and forth, trying to keep in touch with as many people as they could and keep as tight a handle as they could as what was going on the battlefield.
You think that military and intelligence reports exaggerated the military adroitness of the Iraqis. What did you see that really contradicted what you expected to see?
Well, for one thing, the minefields. They were built up to be these monstrous affairs, and the Pentagon just perpetrated the myth. And in reality, several days before the ground war began, they realized that, in fact, the minefields were not as deep or as bad as they thought. And in fact, the Iraqis had marked the minefields with barbed wire so that their own troops wouldn't end up walking through them. And the military commanders knew that the minefields weren't as terrible as advertised, but they didn't want to broadcast that. They didn't want the Iraqis to know that they knew. And I believe also a lot of it was defensive. Sort of the bigger and badder they made the Iraqi military sound, perhaps the more acceptable casualties would be if there were large numbers of them, which many of the commanders expected there to be.
General Schwarzkopf emerged the hero of the Gulf War. How did he look from your vantage point on the battlefield?
Well, there was another side to General Norman Schwarzkopf, and this is not to take anything away from his prowess as a military commander. He obviously is brilliant and did a spectacular job on that front. However, he was a tyrant to work for. He would chew out a general as though he were a lance corporal. He, one night in the middle of a Scud attack, woke up, turned on the CNN TV and saw a tape of a SLAM missile, a standoff land attack missile, which was being used for the very first time in this war, shot off of naval ships offshore. He was furious. He called the chief public affairs officer in the Joint Information Bureau in Dahran, who was down in the basement of the hotel in his chemical suit during a Scud alert, and chewed him out, told him to pack his bags and come to Riyadh the next day. And it was the intervention of General Colin Powell and Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney that helped convince General Schwarzkopf not to fire this colonel. And the reason General Schwarzkopf was so upset is that he had wanted to use that tape in a press conference that he was going to give the next day.
What about his managing of the war?
It ended up being controversial in the end. And part of the reason was because the war moved so quickly. He had some major disagreements and at one point almost threatened to fire the commander, one of his army commanders, General Fred Franks, because he was moving too slowly. And part of the problem with the army general was that the Marines moved so quickly across the battlefield that the army had to start moving 20 hours before they were scheduled to. And it was very difficult to get these tens of thousands of men and their tanks and equipment rolling across the desert in a fashion that General Schwarzkopf considered timely enough.
During the ground war, you were basically on the front line. So you were in the position that women who were actually in the military were not allowed to be. How did they react to your being able to be there?
They were extraordinarily frustrated. Some of them were very angry. There were some women public affairs escorts that the military did not allow to escort media pools into combat because of the combat exclusion laws. And many of these pools that the women military people were not allowed to travel with had women on them. For instance, I was staying at General Boomer's Forward Command headquarters the two nights before the ground war began. I was staying in the tent with the women officers who worked there and were not being allowed to go forward into combat, again, because of the combat exclusion laws. And they were very frustrated that here comes this newspaper reporter who gets to go in and do things and go places that they're trained to do, but the laws don't allow them to do.
You were in the tent with the commander of the Marines, and he talked in his sleep sometimes. Did it sound like he was really troubled? I mean, what did you get from that?
Yeah, it was interesting. A few times as he would doze off to sleep, you know, he would just sound very tormented in talking. And my great fear was that I was going to have to go over up and wake this guy up. And, you know, what would I say to him?
But it's just a nightmare, Commander.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But fortunately, it passed within a few minutes and I never had to do that. But it was very frightening to me the first time it happened because I knew how much pressure these guys were under. You could just see the strain on their faces. And in talking to them, they were just so concerned about the lives of the troops out there.
Did General Boomer admit any of his doubts to you during the war?
He did. I had an extraordinary conversation with him the first night we spent in the tent, and it was just like a floodgate. He just started unleashing all these fears and concerns he'd had for weeks and weeks leading up to the ground war, and they were the kinds of things that he couldn't even discuss with some of his other commanders because he didn't want them to see that he had doubts. He didn't want, you know, the fears to multiply and spread out among the staff. Anytime he spoke to them, you know, he had to be very firm and austere and upbeat about what was going on. So I was in this unique position where finally, essentially, he could let his hair down and talk to somebody about what had been going on in his head all this time.
What were some of the doubts he told you about?
Well, at one point, he just had tremendous fears that they would lose large numbers of troops. He was very upset, despite all the rhetoric that there were no political decisions in this war and that all the decisions were made by the commanders in the field. The British Desert Rats had been assigned to the Marines very early on. But halfway through the buildup, as the war neared, the politicians in London decided, well, they didn't want the Desert Rats with the Marines. The Marines were just supposed to be the supporting attack. They wanted them with a much larger army attack out to the west. So they took them away from the Marines. And the Marines were going up against extraordinary odds facing the Iraqis that were entrenched in Kuwait and thought that they would lose thousands of men. And in the end, the Marines saw far more action than the Army did as a whole.
So the Marines' ranks were lessened at the last minute so that the British could get more of the glory?
Absolutely. And this just terrified Boomer and the other commanders. They were very worried that they just wouldn't have enough men to go in and do the job they needed to do.
Mm-hmm. Information was heavily managed and censored by the Pentagon during this war. You had, you know, what you describe as a front row seat during the ground war. You said you applied some self-censorship because you didn't want to do anything that would put American troops at risk. What kinds of guidelines did you use to decide what not to print?
Well, I relied a lot on my 5 years' experience covering the Pentagon. And despite what the public thinks, reporters don't just automatically rush out there and put everything they know into print. There was self-censorship all over the place in Saudi Arabia. We were privy to information. We were privy to the war planning maps. Many of us knew the war plan days before the ground war actually began. We knew exactly where the troops were going to be going in. And those of us who had covered the military knew from being taken into the confidences of many of the commanders, what we should report and what we shouldn't report. It wasn't a matter of reporters out there willy-nilly putting the lives of troops at risk. Because one thing the American television viewers and newspaper readers may not have realized, we were going to be out there with the troops. So why would we report anything that would endanger our lives as well as the troops' lives? We had a very vested interest in being very careful about what we reported.
Molly Moore, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Molly Moore is the author of A Woman at War. She's now the Washington Post's New Delhi bureau chief. I'm Jerry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, an interview with one of the more mysterious figures in American literature. We call Morocco to speak with Paul Bowles. He moved to Tangier in 1931 at the suggestion of Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas. Bowles is best known for his novel, The Sheltering Sky. It's excerpted in a new anthology of his work. Bowles is also a composer. We're listening to his Music for a Farce. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new novel by South African writer André Brink. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton today defended his record after 5 months in office and said that his judgment has never wavered. Mr. Clinton offered a laundry list of domestic and foreign policy decisions, saying that his was the most decisive presidency in recent years. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
After cutting a press conference short yesterday, the president held a brief question and answer session with reporters today after an announcement about positive economic indicators, noting that interest rates are low, unemployment is on the decline, and 700,000 new jobs have been created. The president said the American people would say he has a pretty decisive record.
And I might say, all the heat we're getting from people is because of the decisions that have been made, not because of those that haven't.
The president said he has not retreated on his economic proposals, predicting that final legislation will be in line with principles he originally set out. The president defended his position on U.S. involvement in Bosnia, saying he's not able to lift the arms embargo without Allied support. He admitted, however, it is the one area where his efforts have fallen short. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
Former Texas Governor John Connally has died in Houston at the age of 76. Connally also served as President John F. Kennedy's Secretary of the Navy, and after moving to the Republican Party, served as President Nixon's Treasury Secretary. Connally was wounded when President Kennedy was fatally shot while riding in a motorcade in Dallas in 1963. Connally had been hospitalized 1 month ago with a breathing problem. Senate Republicans failed again today to cut off debate on a campaign finance reform bill, increasing the likelihood that the measure is dead for this year. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
With a vote of 52-45, the Democrats came up 8 votes short of the 60 needed to end the debate on campaign finance reform. It was the second time in as many weeks that the proponents of the bill failed to get an opportunity to vote on final passage. Republicans oppose the bill because it would provide public financing for candidates who accept voluntary campaign spending limits. Before the cloture vote, Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell appealed for an end to the Republican filibuster.
American political campaigns are too long and too expensive. The central feature of this bill is a cap on spending, a limit on spending. That's what we need in American political campaigns.
Another cloture vote is scheduled for tomorrow, but Mitchell has said he will abandon the bill unless the filibuster is ended by the end of the week. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the Capitol.
Cuban officials have announced that the nation's armed forces have been cut because of hard economic times. Cuban officials also indicated their intentions to work out reparations for U.S. properties confiscated in the 1960s. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 22 points to close at 3,492. This is NPR News. In Capitol Hill, the House has approved a measure that would bar employers from hiring permanent replacements for workers who go out on strike. The vote approving the measure was 239-190. However, the bill now goes on to the Senate, where it appears it will not be approved. Conservative Democrats in the House argued that chances for approval in the Senate are so slight that the House should not have acted on the measure at all. The National Cancer Institute has recorded a significant increase in the number of men being diagnosed with prostate cancer in the United States. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
The increase is dramatic, 16% from 1989 to 1990. That's the largest increase for a single year that the Cancer Institute has recorded since it began tracking all cancers in 1973. But that doesn't necessarily mean that more men are getting prostate cancer. It may just mean that more cancers are being detected. Several years ago, doctors started using a blood test to help them detect prostate cancer. They're now picking up very early cancers, which may otherwise have gone unnoticed. No one knows if these cancers really need treatment because, at least in many older men, the cancers grow so slowly that the men may die of something else first. This year, 165,000 men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer. About 35,000 men will die of it. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
The government says that the nation's trade deficit dropped nearly 12% in the first quarter of the year. The first quarter deficit came to nearly $21 billion, down from more than $23.5 billion in the last 3 months of last year. Government officials say improved figures came from a surplus in services and investment income and a drop in transfers, including U.S. foreign aid payments. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Paul Bowles is one of the more mysterious writers in American literature and one of the more enduring cult figures. Norman Mailer once wrote about him, "Bowles opened the world of hip. He let in the murder, the drugs, the incest." Tobias Wolff described Bowles' stories as austere, witty, violent, and sensuous, and described Bowles as one of our most serious and authentic literary talents. Bowles is best known for his 1949 novel, The Sheltering Sky, set, like most of his nightmarish stories, in northern Africa. He's lived in Tangier since 1931. His presence helped make Tangier a stop for many writers disenchanted with America, including William Burroughs, who wrote Naked Lunch there. A new anthology of Bowles' writing, called Too Far From Home, has just been published by Echo Press. Bowles is 82 now. He rarely gives interviews and, because of a bad leg, seldom leaves his apartment. He hasn't had a telephone for decades, but we were able to reach him through the phone of his downstairs neighbor. I asked Bowles to think back to 1931 and describe what struck him most about Tangier when he arrived.
Well, the way the Moroccans behaved, they all, I watched them by the hour because they all seemed to be performing. Theatrical audience, and they're wonderful doing that. That was something one could see at any moment of the day, anywhere. But above all, I loved their rituals, especially the religious brotherhoods, who were quite amazing. They still exist, but without the violence that they had back then.
What was the violence like within the religious brotherhoods?
Well, it depended on the brotherhood. The Aisawa, they threw themselves into a nest of cactus. They ate scorpions. They bit off the heads of serpents. They bit off the top of a bottle and chewed it, swallowed it. It was very strange. I'd never seen anything like it. And not at all hoaxed, fake, no. They were not doing it for an audience. They were doing it because it had to be done.
Well, the things that you were just talking about, the kind of violence and pain or transcendence of pain, I think relate to some of the imagery in some of your stories.
Yes, well, yes, of course. I was particularly taken by the attributes of certain of the manifestations, the ceremonies. The Jilala, another group, I've watched, they slash themselves arms and legs, and so till they're completely painted red, and then they lose consciousness, fall on the floor, and they're brought back to consciousness by different music, different rhythm of drum, and then they claim that they have left this world. They claim they're walking on air when they come to, which must be very pleasant.
You have stories about Westerners who go to faraway places and get into deep trouble. once they get there, torture, enslavement. I mean, your story, A Distant Episode, is about a professor of linguistics who goes to a Northern African village looking for interesting dialects.
That's right.
And he ends up with his tongue cut out, and he's basically made into a village performing pet. And after the wound heals, it takes quite a while before the more existential feeling of pain starts to stir in his being. I'm wondering if there were any, like, nightmarish experiences that were ever a part of your life by virtue of having moved from the West.
No, most of my experiences have been very pleasant. I invent nightmares to balance the pleasantness of life.
Have you ever been afraid of your imagination?
No. How would it feel? What would you do?
Try not to fall asleep, I think.
That would be a delightful way to live.
Your father was a dentist.
That's right.
And that must have been a pretty scary thing in a way. Kids always hate going to the dentist, but that was your father's job. So, I mean, and you think of the dentist as the person who administers pain.
That's right.
I'm wondering if this is, if there's any, I feel silly even connection. Asking this, any connection, yeah.
Probably, yes, although I never liked any dentist, and I liked my father least of all. And he wasn't, I didn't think he was a very pleasant, polite dentist, not with me anyway. He made me feel like a criminal.
For what?
The way he would open your mouth and give me orders as though I were evil. And that's the way he functioned.
Your father used to do your dental work?
Yes. Very bad.
It hurt a lot?
Oh, it always does. But I had more than that. He took me to an orthodontist. And for 10 years, I had the braces on my teeth, a band on each tooth and an arch inside and an arch outside because the canines were coming in too high up. You know, children have malformed teeth.
Mm-hmm.
But mine all came out all right, of course, because of 10 years of going and having the screws on the arches tightened, and then it pulls all over your mouth, both upper and lower. Very painful, and you can't eat. I don't know. I think perhaps it's just as well to have crooked teeth.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Paul Bowles. He's joining us on the phone from Tangier, where he's lived since the early 1930s. There's a new anthology of his writing called Too Far From Home. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Writer Paul Bowles is my guest. He's joining us from Tangier by phone. I want to get back to how you were or were not changed by living in Tangier. There's a character named Ahmet in The Sheltering Sky who says, "Life is amazing. Nothing ever happens the way one imagines it is going to. One realizes that most clearly here. All your philosophic systems crumble. At every turn, one finds the unexpected." When you got to Northern Africa, did your philosophic systems crumble? I mean, did...
I don't think I had any.
Uh-huh.
No. I didn't know what North Africa was. Gertrude Stein brought me here, sent me here. And
You had met her in Paris, and you asked her where you should go?
That's right. I was staying with her out in Bérignac, down near Aix-les-Bains. She had a summer house, lovely place. And after about 2 weeks, she said, "Well, where are you going when you leave?" And I said, "Well, I guess I'll go to Villefranche." And she said, "Oh, shame on you. Anybody can go there." And then we talked and we talked. Finally, I think Alice Toklas said, why not Tangier? And Gertrude Stein said, it's a good idea. She liked it. She was here back long, long ago, I think the beginning of the century, which is quite a while ago. And she said, you'll like it. You like sunlight. You like heat. You'll get that there every day, all the time. I don't think she liked that, but I did, so I had a wonderful time. And I was with Aaron Copland. He wasn't very fond of Morocco.
You'd been studying with Aaron Copland?
Yes, I have, since the autumn of 1929, right.
You write that when you met Gertrude Stein, she said that you fascinated her because you seemed like the American suburban child with its unrelenting spleen. What do you think she meant?
Oh, I don't know. I remember she said, you started your life of crime too young. But what the crime was, I don't know. She was a very amusing woman.
Very elliptical.
Oh, yes, you're never quite sure what she meant. But she always meant something. And generally, it was perfectly sensible.
When we were talking before about the religious brotherhoods that
yes.
you observed, do you think of yourself as a spiritually absorbed person?
I don't know what that means.
Spiritually concerned. Are you interested in things that are mystical or spiritual?
No, I'm not.
So your interest is more about the behavior of the people than in a kind of like spiritual seeking?
Well, I don't know what spiritual things are. You know, I don't really know. I know the word, yes. I've never come into contact with mm-hmm. spiritual people.
Do you feel a lot like an outsider living in a country where a lot of people are very religious and the religion isn't at all close to the religion or to the religions that you grew up near?
I never grew up with any religion. My family were all agnostics back to the, all four of my grandparents, too, so they never had any connection with any orthodoxy, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had no religious instruction. I wasn't taught to believe in God. I wasn't taught to do anything. Naturally, I never did. If you don't tell a child while it's young that there is God and all the rest of it goes with it, it's never going to invent it itself. It'll just go through life without an idea of it, which, of course, I think is preferable, but obviously millions of people don't. It's not that I have anything against religion. But I think it's a very good idea to force it into small children.
I know the thing I really wanted to ask you, if you have time for one more question, and I'm afraid this might be an unanswerable question. I think it might be too big a question, but let me give it a shot and feel free to tell me it's too big a question. Do you feel that you have been changed in any truly fundamental way by having uprooted yourself from the West and move to Tangier. And I'm also wondering if you wanted to be changed, if that's part of the reason why you moved so far away, if you wanted to be changed.
No. I never thought of myself as a person, what I wanted or didn't want, no. I always thought of myself as a recording machine. In order to want this or want that, you have to have an ego. I don't think I have that.
You don't think you have an ego?
No, I don't think so.
You don't think of yourself as a person, you think of yourself as a recording machine.
That's right.
No desires?
To what?
I don't know, you name it. Eat, sleep?
Desire.
Yeah.
Well, when I'm hungry, I have a desire to eat. When I'm tired, I have a desire to sleep. Yes. But what you were speaking of desires which transcend that,
Well, I don't know. I was thinking of all desires, because you said you had no ego.
Well, it's a silly thing to say, but I never feel that it's terribly important if I get what I want or if I don't. And I'm not in competition with anyone else in the world. I just am living, and soon I'll be dead. that's the way life is.
You said that very matter-of-factly. I mean, is this something that you're fearful of or dreading or just...
What,
that's
death?
The way it is? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, I don't dread it. How can you dread something? Death is part of life. There's no life without it, so you might as well not dread it. Painful death, yes. A pacific, tranquil death, I think, fine.
Paul Bowles spoke to us from Tangier. A new collection of Bowles' writing called Too Far From Home has just been published by Echo Press. Bowles is also a composer. Here's some of his music. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton held a news conference earlier today. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on that, on All Things Considered?
The president touched on Bosnia, on Somalia, and on his nomination to the Supreme Court, Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and we will cover all those points, Terry. Also, Nina Totenberg will take a little bit closer look at Judge Ginsburg's views on abortion, and we'll explore the meaning of a phrase the president used today, Adams off ox. Also, the largest black-owned business in the country has been sold in a stock swap. There's a new study on cholesterol. Bob Garfield is looking at the man who holds the record for holding Guinness World Records.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. André Brink is among South Africa's most distinguished writers. His novels include An Act of Terror, A Dry White Season, and States of Emergency. Our book critic, John Leonard, just returned from a lecture tour in South Africa and found Brink's new novella waiting for him at home. Here's John's review of Cape of Storms.
By accident 6 weeks ago, I found myself on a Saturday morning at Oliver Tambo's funeral in a soccer stadium in Soweto. And later that night at a reception Nelson Mandela gave in Johannesburg for foreign dignitaries who had come to South Africa for that funeral. Giddy and jet-lagged, I kidded Nadine Gordimer. It wasn't working out the way she'd predicted in A Sport of Nature. No, she agreed. The bloody revolution she'd predicted in A Sport of Nature had been just wishful thinking on her part. On the other hand, and she smiled sweetly, it was working out the way she'd imagined in July's People. In July's People, a black gardener must save the lives of the white liberals he used to work for by hiding them in his village. Gordimer wanted me to think about Mandela's peculiar responsibility for South African whites. Instead, I thought about parables. Between ferocious realistic novels, white South African writers seem driven to parable, as if looking for a way to surprise their readers into moral scruple. Gordimer wrote July's People between Burger's Daughter and A Sport of Nature. J.M. Coetzee warmed up for the Age of Iron with Waiting for the Barbarians. And no sooner had André Brink completed An Act of Terror than he sat down to imagine, in Cape of Storms, the first meeting and the first misunderstanding between the European and the African, as a parable partaking equally of tribal legend, Greek myth, and 16th century epic poem. I can't find Adamastor in my Greek mythologies, but he shows up full-blown in the 16th century epic poem Lusiades, a classic of Portuguese literature. He's a titan who displeases the gods by falling in love with Thetis, the nymph who mothered Achilles. Zeus turns him into a mountain range, all those rocks on the Cape at the bottom of Africa. Thus, according to the poem, Adamastor has it in for European navigators like Vasco da Gama, and storms all over their ships. Brink decides that Adamastor will be a tribal chief of the indigenous peoples of the Cape when Vasco da Gama's seabird appears at the end of the 15th century. This seabird gives birth to some odd eggs, out of which hatch murderous beard men with guns and firewater, as well as one naked European woman, whom the besotted Adamastor kidnaps. This is trouble. As if to parody the Vortrek of the white Afrikaners, Adamastor's people must wander with goatskins through a wilderness of thorns, attacked by jackals and chameleons, stormed on by boulders. Cattle, sheep, and sorcerers die. Until the advent of the crocodile, not only can't Adamastor talk to his nymph, he can't make love to her either. His sexual organ is so enormous, he must wrap it around his waist like a rope. Cape of Storms is not only a parable about language, Adamastor must name the beasts and the emotions, but also very Freudian. Brink is saying that civilization means castration. So by all means, take a look at it. But I also discovered in South Africa a whole other literature of prison and exile I'm ashamed to admit I was ignorant of. Besides white writers like Brink, Gordimer, and Coetzee, there are some amazing black writers being published for the first time in their own country, like Alex Laguma, Bessie Head, and Eskia Maflili. And the richest book of all is The Social Contract, Nelson Mandela himself is writing.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Cape of Storms by Andre Brink. There are many people without whom Fresh Air would never have become a national program. At the top of that list is Bill Siemering, our former station manager at WHYY. That's why we're so thrilled that Bill has just been named a MacArthur Fellow by the MacArthur Foundation. The fellowship is also known as the Genius Award, and recipients get a generous grant, no strings attached. Bill has always been guided by a vision of how America could listen to itself through public radio. His vision has inspired public radio producers ever since he wrote NPR's first mission statement. Bill also created All Things Considered. More recently, he was the founding executive producer of the documentary series Soundprint. I'm sure public radio listeners around the country join us in congratulating Bill Siemering. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Roger Voblaitis, Chris Fraley, Joyce Lieberman, and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Abby Lincoln tells us about singing the song she believes in. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Some folks talk about my power. Some folks say I'm wild and strong. Others say my style of living makes a man go wrong.